Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Get up again and smile. Get up again and smile.
Good morning and welcome to Our Black News. I'm Don Allen, and over in Studio B now is Mr. Jonathan Mason. Good morning, Jonathan. How are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous, Don.
Okay, that's great. You know, this morning we have special guest State Representative Raymond D. on hold. He's sitting there in the queue. But before we start this conversation, I would like to frame this conversation and talk about Minnesota's specific. And as you know, State Representative Raymond Dean is running again for re-election, 58B, if I'm not mistaken, which is North Minneapolis. And when he comes on, he'll explain more. But I felt that this is a parallel. This clip would let the community kind of see and get a glimpse into what's going on, not just here in Minnesota, but on a national level. And with this COVID-19 things happening and the disparities that Black people have in general, we want to address some of these things and stay in our lane and provide news and information that you can use. But first, let's frame it. This is a WCCO news report. I hope you get something out of this.
A new report lists Minnesota among the worst states in America for racial inequality. The website 24/7 Wall Street listed Minnesota as the second most unequal state in the country behind Wisconsin. It measured gaps between Blacks and white residents in areas like unemployment, income, and home ownership. New at 10, WCCO's Jeff Wagner learned what the numbers mean and how organizations are trying to bring balance to Minnesota.
Racial inequality is no secret in the United States. Earlier this month, the tension connected to it ignited in the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia.
We look at Charlottesville, and we look at the tiki torches burning there, but people don't realize we're being scorched every day here in America, especially here in Minnesota.
Minneapolis NAACP President Jason Soule feels his point is validated thanks to a recent study by 24/7 Wall Street, which labeled Minnesota as the second most racially unequal state in the country, right behind Wisconsin and just ahead of South Dakota, Illinois, and Iowa.
I'm from Chicago. I graduated in Waterloo, Iowa. I've been living in Minnesota the last 17 years. Every place I've lived, I felt this immense pressure.
The study found that Black people in Minnesota are 10 times more likely to end up in jail or prison than white people. It also found the median income for a Black household is just over $30,000, but a white household is double that number. Race relations experts feel those two statistics are directly connected.
If you do have employment, it pays a very low wage. You are a renter at best, and then if you are thoroughly outside of the labor market and participating in the underground economy, then you may end up in jail.
Soule says fixing the issues starts by holding government entities and law enforcement accountable. Mobilizing is the next step.
Use that report and analyze it critically. Let's talk about it with our families. What do these numbers represent?
That study also found that Black people in Minnesota have a home ownership rate of 21%, but the number for white people was more than triple at 76%.
And Jeff, how about Minnesota's education system? How will that play into this?
You know, that's where we have that achievement gap that people know about in this state. The latest numbers from the Minnesota Department of Education found that in grades 3 through 8 and also 10th, the amount of white students who met the standard for reading and math was about double that of Black students. So these disparities clearly are beginning at a young age.
All right, Jeff, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that report, you know, my first inclination was to say, what the hell? But there's a lot of craziness going on there. And without further ado, I'd like to bring on Minnesota State Representative Raymond Dean, who's live on the line on Our Black News this morning. Dr. Dean, how are you?
Good morning, Jonathan, and good morning, Don. I'm doing well, thank you.
Okay. First of all, you know, these are tough times, and I know you're running for re-election this year, and I would like you to just, you know, tell people the area you represent There's a lot of good stuff on your website. And just kind of introduce yourself to our listening audience, both domestically and internationally.
Well, John, it's, you know, you're right. It's very, very strange times right now. And I think that that folks are trying to figure out what a new normal is going to look like after we come out of this. And I think that one thing we all have to begin to think about is it's amazing how we as a government, and, you know, I include myself, I'm an elected official, are finding the money necessary to try to make sure that we get through this crisis. But this crisis has been happening in the community for a long, long time. And I would just love it if my colleagues would begin to understand that just because something isn't affecting them personally or their community personally, that it's not an important issue. You know, we know that the past several decades, you know, people of color and communities of color and indigenous folks have really been left behind in so many ways. And I just want to say, you know, it's really been an honor to fight for this community at the Capitol, to try to stress the importance of the resources that are needed. You know, I came into office first in 2012, which was just as we were coming out of the last recession that we had. And we know that roughly 60% of the wealth of Black families were stripped away from them through the mortgage foreclosure crisis, which is one of the things that I first got involved with to try to address that issue. So you know, I mean, over the past few years, I've been working and trying to do a lot of stuff around criminal justice reforms. We know that our system disproportionately impacts, people of color, indigenous folks, and Black folks in a way that it doesn't affect white communities, even though we know that if you look at statistics, there might be slight statistical variation about related to the amount of crimes, but we also know that related to issue around drug crimes, there's no difference. Matter of fact, right. White people actually use drugs at a higher rate than Black people do. And I'm sure some listeners are going to hear that and go, no, that can't be true. But, you know, they've done studies and it is true. Now, you know, it's clear that Black folks are and indigenous folks are disproportionately impacted by our policing, which leads to a lot of problems, because ultimately when communities are over-policed, they tend to be over-arrested, they tend to be overcharged, they tend to be over-prosecuted, and as a result, they're over-incarcerated. And that's an underlying problem that I think is really had a huge, huge impact on the overall health of our community. And at the same time, you know, as the story mentioned, the issue around home ownership is something that is just abysmal. It's not something that's unique to Minnesota, but there are many other states that have a much, much better relationship between white home ownership and Black home ownership. And we know that home ownership is where most people develop generational wealth. And that's one of the key things to success. So, you know, I mean, education, we could do three shows on the issue of education.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they use the, you know, the word achievement gap, and I personally like to use the word opportunity gap.
Okay.
Because we really aren't giving families and we really aren't giving these kids the real opportunity to, you know, be their best selves they can be and achieve to their fullest potential. And Don, I've been watching you around what you're doing with teaching kids, you know, in our education system. I just want to thank you for taking that on and for sticking with it, because I know it's probably you're pushing a rock uphill, but we need a lot of people to get behind those rocks and start pushing them uphill, because that's the only way we're going to be able to really achieve and address some of these issues out in the community. So I probably talked too long, and I'm sure you guys have some questions.
No, that was great.
I know Jonathan has something for you, but just quickly here. In the area of North Minneapolis that you represent, And in all, let's just talk about Minnesota as a whole right now. When we talk about these disparities, I don't want our listeners to think that we're whining or we're doing any of that stuff, because we're problem solvers. And
right.
And the thing is, let's look at North Point. You know, the North Point, there was an article in North News within the last 10 days about, you know, them getting ready for the COVID-19 buildup and, you know, showed a picture of some doctors and some scrubs and some masks and all that. Very, very persuasive picture, persuasive analysis of what's happening. But we know for the last 20 years, over 90% of the people that use North Point are more than 100% below, or 100 percentage points below the federal poverty line.
Yeah.
In those areas, and that's from Hennepin County, it's from an art RFP for people to hang artwork in North Point. That was one of the demographic facts that was on that RFP, if anybody's wondering. And so with that said, all these disparities that come out in that area, it hits that area the hardest. But like you had said a minute ago or 2 minutes ago, that, you know, you have to get your colleagues to understand that, you know, if just because it doesn't hurt them doesn't mean that it's hurting someone else. I'm paraphrasing you there, but how do we get that level of understanding? And before you answer that, we have that Council of Minnesota on African Heritage, and I'm not attacking anybody. I'm just saying that they're doing a crappy job. I almost cursed. And how do we create that policy in the state legislature to make sure these things are addressed is my question. And then after you answer, Jonathan, I'm sure is going to chime in.
Yeah,
sure.
Well, it's, you know, North Point, you know, is one of those places that are sort of the last resort for healthcare. We know that a lot of folks in the community don't have health insurance. And as a result, you know, the county sort of, you know, picks that up. And it's a really, really important thing that we have that. I cannot imagine what our community would be like if we didn't have North Point. And just for the record, I have, you know, pretty good health insurance through the state of Minnesota, and my clinic is North Point. That's where I go.
You're one of the 6% with insurance that uses North Point. Yes.
Yeah, and we need more people with insurance to actually use North Point, because it will actually help them financially. And I tell you, I think I have one of the best doctors that I see, you know, in the whole Twin Cities. I mean, I believe that clinic is second to none. Now, I'm sure there are people that have frustrations with it, as we all know that, you know, when life is hard and, you know, you hit an obstacle, it makes you very, very frustrated, and I certainly understand that. But I think that's an asset, and I know that they're gearing up for, you know, the next couple of weeks when we're going to start to see more and more cases of this coronavirus hit the community.
Right. I had a
relative.
Oh, okay.
Sure. Can I address Council of Minnesotans of African American Heritage?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So you know, that's an interesting sort of council within the state. Its main goal is to work with the governor's office and to inform and voice their concerns regarding the legislation and things that we bring up. And it's, you know, I mean, I'm going to say this, and I don't mean it to be bad at all, but it's a part of government. And as a
right.
part of government, it sort of brings this skepticism with it. You know, I've known the director, Justin Terrell, for quite some time, actually. You know, him and I got our early start around issues with Justice for All at Take Action Minnesota, you know, fighting the issues around employment, fighting for those individuals' criminal records, and fighting for the right to vote for those individuals with criminal records. And, you know, I think they do a fairly good job of reaching out to the community and trying to connect with them, but we're never going to be able to connect with everybody. I certainly understand that some folks may not feel that they're doing, you know, what they would like them to do. But I'll tell you, relative to what they're charged with within the state statutes that authorize them, they're meeting their obligations. So, Don, you and I could go back and forth on this.
Yeah, we could. You know, during the bare minimum, I guess it's okay. Go ahead.
But I had a question with the African-American heritage as well, just, you know, because I've dealt with personal level when Thurman Blevins got killed, and I was leading some of the protests on that. And, you know, simply as a person in part of the community as well, I was fighting for simply transparency and accountability. And, you know, they use that that office, you know, as more of a defense for a defense for the community as far as toning them down or putting a Band-Aid on us as far as when we're seeking information or wanting change. It was simply about body cam. So it was about the body cam, and whether he was in the right or the wrong, we just wanted to see what was going on, and it took too long. So they sent Justin Terrell, and me and him, I don't have a problem with the guy. I love that the fact that he is fighting also for the community, but more of they put him in a position of trying to, you know, do what they've always done within this system, as trying to pick a token black individual to calm down the community so they're not upset, you know. And what all I think the community, whether it's if we talked about housing and, you know, the achievement gap and the opportunity gap, and those are clever words. And, you know, I've heard these words all the time, achievement gap. It's almost like an oxymoron to me, because you're like saying it's achievement gap. Well, the gap is there because it's strategically designed there. So I think we have to address the people who are putting these things in play and then playing like, you know, they have already a system in play for it. So my question to you is, when the community is voicing the concerns maybe about North Point, so whether they have enough PPE, and that's personal protective equipment, if we have, you know, if they're working alongside the government and, you know, other organizations within our, county, whether it's Hennepin County or the state of Minnesota, when we have places like North Point serving the community, and it seems like they're maybe not having enough stuff like they need, but we're running a surplus, and we have 3M, and we have places like Cargill and Target that are here that are, you know, sometimes getting tax benefits. Why aren't those places, you know, helping fulfill some of the need, knowing that these places are benefiting off of the system that's in place? So for me, I'm more of like wondering why they have these, the African-American heritage in play if they're not pushing legislation or fighting for those communities that you represent.
Yeah, well, Jonathan, I would say they are fighting. They're fighting as hard as they can. The difficulty is we don't see a lot of results. And, part of the reason is what I spoke to earlier. There are people whose lives are totally disconnected to the struggles that a lot of people out in the community have here. And they don't understand why people just don't make their lives better.
Is it because of a lack of empathy, or is it systematic? Is it systematically done, whether it's, you know, we talk about the achievement gap. In Minneapolis, the report just said that, and this is things that, you know, I'm at the school board meeting every Tuesday, you know, with Carrie Jo, and I'm talking to Ed Graff, and I'm trying to figure this stuff out. Well, we know these things are happening, and we're not doing anything as far as, like, hiring teachers. The teachers are 4%, 5% of color, but 60 to 70% of the kids in the Minneapolis Public School District are black. So it just... It boggles me how we don't just put a plan together to address some of these issues. And it's not hard. It's who is the human resource, who's doing human resources, and who's hiring. And are there any black people, you know, for example, I'm just touching on education, but are there any black people applying? And if they are, why aren't they being hired? And those are the questions that we have to ask. And it's not about calling somebody racist and saying, oh, they're just doing as much as they can, because like we said with COVID-19, the money is there. So So if we talk about reparations, the money is there. If we know that the Federal Reserve print the money and Jerome Powell is shooting it out, and the Fed said that they're going to give us $1 trillion each day last week or 2 weeks ago, and they just signed $2 trillion and inserted $2 trillion. That's about $10 trillion. They sure enough got enough money, and Minnesota definitely has enough money. So when we have these areas, you know, and I'm just talking about Minneapolis, North Minneapolis as well, of, you know, black people who are oppressed, over-policed, and they're confined in an area, and we know it's due to redlining. The loans weren't being approved because they were black, and other white communities didn't want them in there. Do we address this through legislation and say, now it's time to address some of these things to make it right? And, you know, we have tons of land, farming land, that the farmers are getting bailed out. And a lot of them receive that land. You know, we know a lot of people, I'm sure you know a lot of people, who have tons of land. And that land was given, obviously it's stolen land, but it was given right through the 1862 American Homestead Act. And it was given to tons of white people. And so if you're talking about the generational wealth gap, we have to start talking about affordable housing and maybe taking some of that land back from some of these people who are getting grants from the government because they're not cultivating the land, and maybe building some of this affordable housing outside of the city, so the city can resume, you know, they can resume, because we know that that the change is coming for the inner cities, for North Minneapolis. So if we're going to be honest with the people, is the North Side going to be removed in the next 10 years due to, you know, all the things that are happening right now as far as, like, gentrification and stuff like that?
Jonathan, let me acknowledge, you know, one of the things that you all said, and I'm not sure if it was just you or if Don added to. I mean, you know, the system's working. You know, the system that we have in place is working. It's designed so that, you know, folks in poorer communities, people of color, can achieve. So we have to change and break down a system. And when it comes to issues of teachers of color, over the past about 5 or 6 years, we've been pushing hard to get money into the education system, the higher education system, for teachers and for those, you know, college students that want to become teachers, college students of color. We've been doing things like trying to create stipends for individuals when they go through their student teaching process for, you know, teachers of color, so that they can do that. And we're working, I mean, we're working as hard as we can.
I don't mean to cut you off. Is that process, yes, when you're making these stipends available? Because we know with, like, Betsy DeVos, and when teachers, and I'm going to talk about teachers as a whole, when they right took on these public service roles, and they said that, hey, you know what, if you get your bachelor's degree, you go into these inner city areas and you work for the public, that you'll get these student loans forgiven. And now we know that Betsy DeVos did about 13 out of the 55,000 people who did it. Are people of color going to tackle on more debt, and then these things are not going to be available for them?
Well, again, we could do a whole nother show on Betsy DeVos. But I would just say, Jonathan, that trying to get money in the system so that those individuals that want to go into teaching, you know, people of color, black folks, have that opportunity. Because you're absolutely right. It's unconscionable that, you know, 6% of the teachers in Minneapolis public school are of color, when we know that it's, you know, 65 or 70% students of color. And you know, I mean, Don, you can speak to this, you know.
Yeah.
There's a different thing that happens when a young student looks in the front of the classroom and they see someone that looks like them. A different thing happens there.
Exactly. And I just want to interject something in this conversation about the teaching fee. One of the biggest problems that I see in there for any teacher, I'm not convinced that only black people can teach black people, but what I am convinced of is that we need more people that look like me and some of our kids as teachers, administrators in these schools. I agree with that. But just the teaching pathway, to our listeners, to to State Representative Raymond Dean, who's live on the air with us, representing 58B, that's North Minneapolis. I'd just like to say that process and the rules on the books and how they followed the rules, depending on who you are, and also the Pearson testing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a tenured teacher to now go take a content test for like $57 for each test, I think it is. And it asks you 50 questions in each test that are irrelevant, totally irrelevant, if you're in my area of teaching.
So who puts those guidelines or regulations in place?
It comes from
God knows.
Just real quick here, it comes from the state legislature to the professional. It used to be the Board of Teaching, but the thing is, they're still using Pearson, and I don't mean to step on this because I know we're talking to State Representative Ray Dean, but I just want to give you guys some information on this so we can speak intelligently about it, because I've been through the process at every level. And so with that said, I think the reason why there are so few black teachers or black folks going into teaching is, one, the pay is not that great. Number two, you have to do 6 weeks of teaching somewhere, depending on some 12 weeks, some 6 months, depending on what discipline you're taking. Like special ed is like might be 12 weeks of student teaching where you don't make a nickel. And the money that the state, the higher ed department gives you is peanuts. You can't cover your bills with that. And so that's one thing. But then I went through three master's programs completely as the only black person in the room. We, in some cases in Minnesota, we as black men and women are not hitting that higher ed mark, and keep, you just can't do four and relax. You need to keep going if you possibly can. And out of those rooms, especially in education, and the school I went to, you know, God bless their souls, but they have a urban teaching school inside of the school of education, and there's not one black, Hispanic, Asian teacher in the school of urban teaching.
Right.
So that's a problem. But anyway,
yeah,
I just have to reject that.
It is done. Let me correct one thing you said twice. You said 58B, it's actually 59B.
90, okay, something like that.
just correct that.
One quick thing, I would talk on some of the systematic things I wanted to ask you. As far as like Pelsby, do you work with Pelsby at all?
I do not. That's not, you know, I mean, Jonathan, I sort of focus in a few areas. One is issues related to criminal justice reform. I'm involved with the bonding or the capital investment committee. I deal with commerce committee. And then I, you know, because it's a personal interest and a pretty solid knowledge set for me, issues around climate change and climate justice. So that's sort of my
Area. Yeah. Okay. So as far as climate justice, so the Upper Harbor Terminal.
Yes.
What's the information on that in the next 5 to 10 years as far as what are their plans with that?
Yeah, well, that's been, you know as well as I do that it's been a pretty controversial project out in the community. I think we've had several loud voices that are objecting to it, and I think their concerns are real concerns. I've been happy to see what the city's done to try to include those people in the planning of what that might look like and what it might be. And
right.
I think that it could be a real opportunity for the North Side if done right. And
right.
I think it could be really tragic for the North Side if it's done wrong.
Okay.
So I'm really glad that the city of Minneapolis slowed down their process to allow the community to engage. And a lot of people that are hard objectors still may not like the project. But I think the city engaged them and listened to them. You know, right now it's really just looking at a phase one portion of the project.
Okay.
You know, it's supposed to have, you know, two more phases, a phase two and a phase three. And it's phased for lots of different reasons. We don't know, you know, what the actual need might be in 5-6 years when phase two comes online.
Right.
And I say that, you know, right now, if they were designing like office or, you know, apartment buildings in that particular thing. They'd be designing them one way. I have a feeling that how we design offices are going to change. We're probably going to have more people working remotely, which means we're going to change how we design apartments. So I, you know, I mean, I think in phasing it, it's a good process. I know that, you know, there are a lot of objections to the folks at First Avenue being engaged with that project. But, you know, I've seen Dana Frank, you know, put out what I would say is a pretty incredible community benefits agreement.
That will really benefit
the North Side. I want people that are objecting to it to continue to object to it, and because I think that makes it a better project in the end.
Right. And constructive criticism, I think, is always going to be beneficial for everybody, especially in that area. I would, you know, as far as, you know, what that looks like, what it feels like for the North Side and how they can participate in it, even building it and getting them prepared in the necessary things, you know, that we're going to need in the future. And we know that, you know, whether it's I kind of think that Trump is going to win again. You know, I'm not just saying I'm not really a political, whether it's either or, but I think he's going to win again. And there is going to be monies going towards infrastructure. And I think, you know, being that, you know, we had the 35W bridge fall down and they rebuilt it, that kind of triggered the, you know, the conversation around infrastructure. And I know that communities of color that are, you know, right now primarily in the city and actually on the most valuable real estate with gentrification and stuff coming in, how can they, you know, how can we implement a program for some of these people that are residing in the community, grew up in the community, where they can take part ownership, and it's not at extreme high, you know, rates and home rates and stuff like that, because we know that in the next 5 to 10 years, the North Side, and it's always been location, is prime area for, you know, investors and developers. So how can we kind of get the conversation going towards helping the community be able to still keep a portion of that, you know, that area without giving it away, or, you know, like the generational wealth gap. So is there anything in place for them?
Well, I think there are a few things that are, you know, sort of in the hopper that's being considered. You know, when it comes to the housing that's going to be for Harbor Terminal, I've been a big advocate for 50% of the homes being affordable, which, you know, affordable to the area median income is really not affordable to North Minneapolis. But
right.
I think that 50% should be affordable, and 50% of that should be deeply affordable. And what that means is that's a 30% area median income, which is more realistic for individuals that may struggle on the North Side. And if we can get, you know, if they end up building 1,400 units, and if we can get 700 units of those affordable and 350 units of those deeply affordable, it's sort of one, it changes the pressure across the freeway. But two, it also begins to create a community in an area where we have different people of different economic means living together. And I think that that's an important thing. You know, there's been a lot of studies done around the issue of gentrification, and it unfortunately, it's often said that, you know, an area doesn't really improve until it becomes 51% white.
Right.
And once it becomes 51%,
whoever's making the study saying that. But
And then it's only a matter of time before, you know, the opportunities, the economic opportunities for a lot of folks change the community. I think we need to do some things in the city, and, you know, I'm happy to work with my colleagues at the state to try to make it possible, albeit difficult, because I'm telling you, there are a lot of legislators in the state of Minnesota that aren't fans of Minneapolis. I would love to create an opportunity so that we could increase that 21% of black home ownership And we could look at North Minneapolis as sort of a, you know, a location to actually try to pull this off. You know, let's try to make it 50% or higher than 50% ownership.
I need to interject right there, right here.
Okay.
We have a few more minutes with State Representative Raymond Dean. But, you know, this is, you know, the 21% home ownership thing and what we're talking about here, what Jonathan was saying, it's like it would be great to have all that. It would be beautiful, but we're solving the problem from the top down. First of all, you know, in 2008, I sat in some community. Matter of fact, Mr. Edwards and I sat in this meeting in North Minneapolis off Glenwood next to the fire station there. There's some kind of community. I can't remember the name of the organization.
By
Harrison.
Harrison, yeah. Okay. And I guess that was the agency or whatever, and some really cool people were there. And this lady came in from, I think, the city and the county and someone from the state. Mind you, this is 2008.
Okay.
They did maps, renderings of downtown Minneapolis crossing the bridge, crossing the freeway, and coming in as far as Olson Memorial Highway. I'm talking about office buildings, the whole, and this was in 2008, mind you.
Right.
And, you can't stop that kind of progress when it's planned so far ahead. But I understand the point of view about the generationally poor people that have lived in North Minneapolis and that have been in that area. You know, what are you going to do for them? Well, they have to do something for themselves, number one. Number two, these catch-alls need to be in place. But we've been talking about this for as long as I've been doing this show and for as long as I've been alive in Minnesota.
So
yeah,
one thing I can say, real quick. What Mr. Dean said earlier about, you know, the achievement gap and the opportunity gap, that's where I think we need to focus in on the opportunity gap. And where you say we make the opportunity so large for these groups of color and everybody, so there is an opportunity. When you give everybody the equal opportunity to be able to do it, and then, you know, you invest in some of these leaders and stuff like that within the community along with legislation, so you need the whole process working together. But I think if you open up that opportunity for people of color and say, hey, look, this is what home ownership looks like. This is how you start a business. This is how you do your stuff. Here's the opportunity to do it with, along with the schooling to be adequate. You know, Southwest shouldn't be getting way more than the North Side. And I know they're doing the CDD and all that, but how do we open up that opportunity gap? And then, so everybody is able to be able to take a piece of that pie. You know what I'm saying?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Jonathan. And, Don, you're right. The solution isn't going to be from top down, but we know that the problem was created from top down. So top down needs to play a role in that, you know. And you know, there are a lot of people out there that say, you know, folks need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And I see it this way. I see government has a role and responsibility to make sure that people have boots.
Right. Right.
You know, and I don't think that government can solve the problem, but I think we at county and the city needs to be putting things in place to make
right.
it so when folks try really
mm-hmm.
hard to lead their best lives, that they're not hitting obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. Because,
right.
you know, you can only take so more obstacles and then you give up, you know, and Don, there's been a lot of money pumped in the North Side over the past 20 years, but I'll just say this.
Where
is it at? It's been pumped in $2 and $3 million increments. And if you're going to have transformational change, there needs
right.
to be a lot of money pumped in, and not just from government, from the private sector. I always like to talk about Midtown Exchange and what it did around Chicago and Lake Street.
Yes, right.
The city of Minneapolis pumped over $50 million into that project. And, of course, Alina pumped in like $100 million. So that was a real investment. You show me an investment in North Minneapolis over the past 10 years, for 20 years. Mm-hmm. They came from government. It was more than $5 million at a time.
Right, but Lake of Chicago, and you, I know you've been to Lake of Chicago. I've been there millions of times.
Yeah.
It's still, there's an issue. The issue is that you, the money, you can throw money at it all you want, but when you don't deal with the root problem, which we all, it is white supremacy or whether it's systematically done, but it's the people, you know, people have drug issues. There's a lot of stuff that people are dealing with. So it's hard to, you know, you throw this money away and you're not getting it to the people who need the help that are creating the problems within the city. So, you know, we need it, whether it's, you know, we throw money at drug rehabilitation places or stuff like that. We need to have an opportunity. The system is going to work, like you said, and I think Don touched on this as well, as these blueprints and these renderings and your art. I looked you up a little bit, Mr. Raymond Dean, and I think that you like architecture. So the architecture,
I practiced it for a long time.
I know that, you know, those renderings and those blueprints have been in there for a long time. And so with that being said, creating that opportunity for these people of color, and when we do have this money, we need to have oversight. So, you know, I love these groups in North Minneapolis, and there's some groups I don't love. And we need to have oversight so when these groups are getting this grant money, they're not pissing it away. You know, and I hate to say it, and I don't want people making tons of money. You know, all the work that I've done, you know, specifically on the north side, but, you know, fighting for justice and all this stuff, I haven't took a dollar. You know, I haven't took $1, don't need a dollar. It's just out the kindness of my heart. I'm a business owner and I do my own thing. But I think the opportunity, if we have the opportunity where we reach out to people who actually want to make a change, and I know that I can say 85% to 90% of the North Side, if you give them an opportunity, right, and you show and you help show them, we have to understand that the educational gap has hindered a lot of these individuals from being able to understand the system, to be able to even interact with it, to become successful, to understand the things that are readily available for them.
Yeah.
So having this opportunity and saying, hey, let us work with you, and don't be suspicious of us as a government or legislators and stuff like this. Let's work together where we can say we can build this together. We can work with black realtors, black brokers. We can deal with real estate investors, all of them within the city of Minnesota, and work with all of our own people to make it equitable and show that we can be who we say we are in Minnesota, and whether it's Minnesota Nice, let's see what it really is. And so I think if we can build those opportunity channels, we can get a lot of things done quickly, and it won't be as much pushback, because what I think is a lot of the issues that we run into is pushback. So a lot of opposition, but with the opposition, they're just upset with systematic racism, and they haven't dealt with the issues of actually, and this is on, and if I play devil's advocate, the system saying, hey, look, we're not racist. Look, we're just trying to keep our plans going. We want to make more money and stuff like that. And I know the black community does as well, but they don't want to be left out all the time. And I think if we open up that opportunity channel and say, look, let us work all together. Hey, black, white folks, all of us can get money together, and our schools all can be better, and we all can be learning together, and then we can insert affordable housing. Because, hey, look, let's be honest, if I'm paying $2,000 or $2,300 a month to live in downtown right on the edge, and I know affordable housing is across the street and they're paying $500, I'm not going to want to move over there. So there's going to be a lot of issues. So what does that look like without pushing everybody out? So, you know, that's my little two cents on that.
Okay. Hey, State Representative Dean, I didn't mean to keep you this long. I know you have a schedule today and things to do, but in closing, would you like to tell people how they can find out more information about you, donate to your campaign, or whatever you need at this point? And we're going to have you on again, because I think that Jonathan and I need to do a longer show just with you and keep you the full hour, but we want to hit on a couple other things before today's show is over so we don't have to go on weekend.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I appreciate you having me on, and Jonathan, I'd love to talk to you about some of the, architects in the city that are black that are doing amazing work. And we need to make sure that we're lifting them up and making sure that they're engaged in a lot of things that impact our community. But, you know, some of these folks have national and international reputations, and I think folks don't realize within that profession. But relative to me, I'm running for re-election. We're going through a weird process for endorsement because, of course, we can't meet in person now. And then likely to be a primary in August and election in November. You can visit my website, which is raymonddehn.org, and that's RaymondDehn.org. Check me out. Feel free to reach out and contact me. My contact information is on the website, and I would love to hear from folks. I think Don and folks know that I'm always available for people to connect with in the community, whether they want to say doing a great job or whether they want to say, you need to get your shit back on track for the community. So I really appreciate you guys. Really appreciate the show, Don.
Appreciate
you. Just say, I'm sad that Ron is no longer with us, but I'm glad that you're carrying on the legacy of the show and you still have the name attached to it.
Yep. Well, thank you very much for that. We appreciate you having. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So, Jonathan.
Yes.
That was deep.
That was.
Like someone said on Facebook, you were preaching. At this point, don't we need to change the leadership?
We do need to change some. What type of leadership you talk about within the community?
Yeah, within the community, the urban league. Dead.
Oh yeah.
The NAACP. What the hell are they
doing?
African American Leadership Forum, MEDA, all these folks, we need to upend them now before, because you stated this earlier. What is the new normal going to look like if we have these crap agencies not doing what they need to do on behalf of our community? There is more than one black millionaire in Minnesota, okay?
Right.
There needs
right.
to be more than one. Giving money to nonprofits is like you said, they're just kind of controlling the masses. You have a few people that have all this wealth that look like us,
right.
and they're not in the business sector. They can't really hire anybody. They can't make
right.
any.
And that's another thing. And I think we have a lot of issues within. Oh, we have a caller. You said
yeah. We have a couple callers actually. I apologize about that caller. Yeah, we have a couple callers in here. Let's grab this one. He's been sitting here the longest. It tells us the producers say this is Mr. Tucker. Mr. Tucker, you're live on Our Black News. What's your question?
Don, you have to be able to discern the real from the unreal.
Okay.
I think Dean has always meant well, and I don't want to criticize him because he don't control very much anyway. This ideal that they gave North Minneapolis or the African-American community, as it's normally called, a great deal of money. You have to remember, most of those jobs that are created in our community went to people living outside of our community. That's an argument I had all the way back to the 70s with Al Halstead and Don Frazier. And then they come into the community, and they're extremely critical of the community, as I told Don Frazier and Al Hofstede and others. If you dislike Minneapolis to the extent that you dislike it and you're hypercritical of it, why do you want to work for a city that you're hypercritical of? And that goes for a lot of professional people, whether they're firemen or whether they're policemen or social workers. They come into the community, and they're the biggest criticals. They're extremely critical of community, which pays their bills. This idea that they gave North Minneapolis a great deal of money never went to anybody. We had organizations that come to our community that's working with one or two people of color working for them. There was an organization that had, before it's changed, it had two blacks working. See, if you don't have the money, you cannot participate. And if you have all these programs and you make the EDs from people that live outside of our community, you're not helping the community. I have seen elected representatives and other community leaders, or spokespersons, because I don't use the word leader too much, that are hypercritical of our community. They believe that in order to have a good community, that that community must be at least 50% or better white. I've seen that from city council people who did not believe that people of color should run businesses. You got a mindset. I'm not concerned with what other cultures think about us. That doesn't. I haven't spent any time with that since about 1958. Okay? My emphasis has been that we need to spend our own time, energies, and efforts getting our own act together. We spend too much time trying to be accepted versus being respected. And I think as long as we do that, we're not going anything. You're trying to outrun your shadow. We got all these folks who want to be affirmative action officers, equity participation officers, and had never had a lemonade stand, know nothing about business. Don, me and you have been in the room with some of these entities, and we come in the room and we talk about our experience. We come to the second meeting, and they regurgitate everything we said. There is no upside going in a meeting with those folks. You know, you're wasting your time. I'm going to take you back to the 60s.
Oh, I was going to just say real quick, you hit on a major point in that, in the part on trying to be accepted and not respected to the point where you're basically just selling out and being the token black person within a white organization. And I think with business leaders, so what Raymond Dean said, that there are, moguls or whatever in the city, us getting in touch with them and really keeping our plan strategic with an agenda, saying, okay, this is what you guys got your business renderings that on your architectural designs for the city. You guys are saying you're throwing this much money for the black community, but we never see it anyways. Let's have some oversight so we can start building areas for affordable housing for black folks on areas and lands that aren't being used, that said, hold on, you guys gave this land away to, and this has to be done, you know, strategically and systematically. We can't have people just screaming in the street anymore, and then they put the police there, they have the news, and they call us terrorists, and then nothing gets done, and a couple nonprofit organizations get some grant money and they pay themselves director fees and they don't do nothing for the community, and then they're ready to go get another grant. And so I just truly think if we have a strategic plan and agenda and say, hey, look, Raymond Dean, you do the legislation on the money or whatever the case may be for 59B, hey, this is what it looks like. We need to start building black business buildings, black-owned condos. The construction is black-owned. And knowing that this money, we have to quit playing behind the ball. We're always trying to get these people elected, and we're not even focused in on the end game. And we have to understand what's actually going to happen, and we have to start thinking out ahead. And so
Listen, young man, if they don't play the game, they ain't going to be part of the game. There is a little deal that where they wanted to have a credit union. They gave this young city council person X number of dollars. They took 80% of those dollars and required the city council person, or a significant portion of those dollars, as they did in other areas, and hired white consultants and gave them 80% of the money and told them, in order for you to get this project off the ground, you have to use our political consultants. And these are people who supported them politically. You got to dig down deep into this thing to see really what's happening. They haven't gave North Minneapolis a darn thing, not one dime. 80 or 90% of that money went to people who live outside of the community. And that's
right.
A myth.
No, I know.
It's a myth. They haven't given us any money. And economics, as Humphrey says, takes precedence over philosophical ideals. If you're giving the money to people, they're the ones who are making the decisions. I've been in a room with these people over 60 years. 60 years. I haven't seen very much change. The biggest change came in the 60s when the cities were burning. These people come in the room, I'm qualified. Qualified to do what? You weren't qualified prior to the cities being burned down. Don't dilute yourself. Don't dilute yourself.
I don't mean to interject you, but look, one thing I was going to say was this. And now, with that being said, now let's start holding them accountable. And how we can do it is forcing transparency and accountability and saying to these elected leaders, you keep saying all this money is going, okay, now we need oversight on this 15 to 20 million. And what does that look like for the state of Minnesota?
Tell me where the $15 or $20 million went to. Tell me who worked for those organizations. I went into the room several years ago, and the question I asked, who works for you? What's their zip code? Give me their zip code. And the question was answered, and looking at those zip codes, none of those people lived in Minneapolis or none of those people lived in North Minneapolis.
And that's just like on our end. I would touch on, so that goes into like our Minneapolis Park and Rec or the Minneapolis, when they're working for the city, a majority of these people, they work and live outside of the city, but they come and work in North Minneapolis and they're rebuilding the roads. And then some of us are standing around watching them build on their roads as they're talking stuff about us. And I know, and I see, and I've seen it all my life growing up. So I understand that frustration where our money and our taxpayer money is going to other people who come into our city and they're hypercritical. They're hypercritical over the city and how we process and where we live and who lives in it. I totally understand that. But now moving forward, now that's been acknowledged, now let's hold people like Raymond Dean accountable and saying, okay, you're going up for reelection. If we have to deal with the system, we got to start saying, let's deal with the system instead of hooting and hollering. And I think
let me interject. Since we got Mr. Tucker on the line and we do have another call, caller, we'll get to you in about 60 seconds here. Is that I'm listening to this, and I've been knowing Mr. Tucker. Mr. Tucker knew my father, okay? So I've been with Tucker a long time. And so the thing is, Mr. Tucker, what you're saying, we've had thousands of these conversations. And like you said, we've been in the room with some of these knuckleheads. And so at this point, before we go back to whatever normal is, or normal is supposed to represent for the black community in Minnesota, my question on the table is, do we need to change the leadership? It's a rhetorical question because, yes, we do. But
hey, No. Hold it. You got to find out, like the Wizard of Oz, you got to find the green man behind the curtain. You don't know who the green man is behind the curtain. And if you're not able to bring pressure on those folks behind the curtain, who are, as my grandmother used to say, throwing rocks and hiding their hands, you're whistling in the dark.
Yeah.
Some of these politicians don't control a darn thing. Let's get real. Obama didn't control anything. Stop playing games with ourselves. You know?
Okay,
you've got to know what button to push.
I'm going to need you to hold on. Mr. Tucker, stay with us. Jonathan, hold on. Let's get this last caller here. Caller, you are live on Our Black News. This is question or comment.
That's on me?
Please.
Thank you so very much for having me this morning. It is beautiful to get up and see black folks organizing, figuring out Where is our fair share? Where's our fair share, Don? I'm going to tell you. Not only do I have an issue with our elected politicians, I got a problem with our education system. And I know I'm singing to the choir. But let me first address this. I am a small business owner. I have multiple streams of income. That's the one thing we don't teach each other. We teach each other how to struggle. We don't teach each other how to be successful. That's number one.
Right.
Number two, the majority of us over here, we don't own anything, so we can't change anything. Now, let me skip to this. I'm a lobbyist. I go over to the House of Representatives, and I'm finna call y'all out because you don't even teach us how valuable the sixth floor is at the House. That's where all the bills get written. That's how all the bills get written. But I'm calling out the people that's in office right now, period. Like, I know what I'm talking about. I go over there. I can count on one hand how many black folks is in the halls up there on the sixth floor trying to get a bill signed, trying to get it introduced. You need an author and somebody to introduce it. There's millions of dollars over there. I'm going to give you an example. Tab Key wrote a bill so that the ambassadors, a.k.a. the trip people, can jump on a train for $1 million. I went over there and amended the bill for $250,000. Where is it equitable for black folks to jump on that train and also do outreach? When you get to North Minneapolis, when you get to Minneapolis, period. I was met with a lot of opposition because I jumped on that bill. Then, the most important thing, we already have houses sitting over in our neighborhoods sitting vacant. We can't get nobody over there to address that. Abandonment of receivership would work. We can't get nobody over there to help write no bills on that. My main problem that I have is DHS. The Department of Human Services holds on to people's criminal backgrounds for 15 years. So you want us to go flip burgers forever. That's a lie.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody doing that. Ain't nobody doing that. Ain't no real jobs. Stop talking about recreating jobs when you got entrepreneurs out here with entrepreneur skills that could be out here pushing T-shirts instead of pushing bags. Quit playing. Like Brother Tucker said, we not really seeing the importance of job creation. We got a whole building sitting empty. I don't see nobody supporting Brother Jamez Staples over there. He got a whole building sitting over there. I'm trying to create a command center for COVID-19. We need to be in on part of that money. Where's our fair share? Then they got us jumping through all type of hoops just to get to fill out the application. A lot of people don't understand that process. Then they got, we have money. You can go through our e-supplier with the city or our portal. Come on, man. That's too much red tape. There are people dying right now. We need help right now. Right. Why is it that black folks are always in a state of emergency? Right now we need some help. We need testing sites right now in North Minneapolis.
Yeah. Go ahead. Preach. Go ahead.
You know
what
I mean? I'm so serious, man. Like, why are we always
keep
the
going
last?
In.
You know, we
keep going
always
in.
The
no,
last.
No, you said it.
You know, we always at the end, man. Like, now we got to stay in the house. We got to stay in the house because the virus is now in the air so bad that, you know, we get headaches now when we go outside. I ain't never seen no virus like that. Are we sure this is just a virus? Are we being duped here? Because I ain't never seen the flu be in the air where it give me a headache. I ain't got nothing but a headache every time I go out there. Now I
got
to put a mask on.
I got a
headache
too.
First it was mask off, now it's mask on. There are so many different issues. That is what I'm saying, Don. You know, along coupled with we can't get kids to get adequate education, okay? There's so many, and now we're starting to see that. You think kids is going to be at the computer when they didn't let kids out of school? They was doing bad while they was in school. What makes you think that when they at home they're going to be able to study?
Oops, there
so
it is.
So it's just so many different things we're coupled with. And the House of Representatives and some of the senators. That's why I reached across party lines and went over there to them Republicans. They want some change for North Minneapolis. They want some change.
I'm glad you said that. This is another thing that we have to start addressing. A lot of the Democratic leadership that wants to get elected uses the Black community as a footstool so they can be able to jump off and be able to get their career lifted, and then it looks like they're with the community and stuff like that. And we have to understand, we can get some stuff done. This whole system is not for us at all. So when you're talking about reaching across party lines, ain't no party lines. Whoever's going to help us right now, whether it could be Republicans or Democrats, we're going to run with them.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, all the stuff that you touched on, I got one word for it, and that's called oppression. And that's why people with heart attacks, got cancers due to stress, got all of these things. It's a jump hurdle.
Heart disease.
Everything you go through. And then it's a runaround. Once you get to where you're spot, you know the information. Now they mad that you got the information. And that's when you touched on going up to the sixth floor and you combated with the 250,000 and you start getting weird faces because now they know, hold up. She knows exactly where all of the money, that where the most important spots are. And now that's where the envy and all the hate comes in. But we have to now go the next step, and we can't back down. We have to be respected. Don't worry about being accepted and saying, nope, nope, nope. On that sixth floor, we need this, this, this. And if you ain't going to do it, we're not going to be up at your rallies. We're not going to endorse you. We're going to come at you at every single turn. And trust me, Black folks know how to turn the heat up. And so we must keep on turning the heat up. And we need to stop tiptoeing, scratching our head when it doesn't itch,
and tap dancing.
Because we're steady in the same position, whether it's Obama, I don't want to hear it. And then they're mad at Trump talking about the immigration, and Obama sent more people over deportation than him, and they don't. Oh well, don't talk about that. I'm so tired of the system using us, and now it's time for us to really have an agenda in place, get the strategic people in order, like Jamez. I already know Jamez's been doing that. He's over there, got the building open. He's been trying, talking to legislators, talking to all the business people. And no one seems to help him out and can't do it. And he's literally working himself off. So, keep on doing your work, brother, because I know you're out there working. And I'm ready to get with you and my sister right here. And Raymond Dean, I need you. If this is your area, I need you on it too. So we need to all get together, and we can yell, we can scream and talk and do all that. But it's time to sit down at one of these coffee shops in Minneapolis and say, let's get it together. Let's have a plan and touch on it regularly.
I agree 100%. With that said, we have a couple more phone calls I'd like to get in. Hold on.
Thank you, Don.
Please. Hold on. Where? Caller, last 42192, you're live on Our Black News. What's your question or comment? Hello, caller. Okay, you're going back on hold. And we also have M calling. The producer tells us this is M calling from his palatial estate in South Minneapolis. M, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing good. I'm doing really good. Really great, great show. And, you know, you tell your co-host, your brother, that when they had that meeting, please give me an invite because I want to come to it. And my comment, though, right now is how in the world did this congressperson, Ilhan, get in, okay? How will somebody come in and get in? Their background is sketchy. I mean, marry this guy. I mean, personal lives, I mean, that's none of my business. Anybody's personal life is none of my business. But if this had been a regular African African-American person with that type of – that would have been blasted all over the papers. That would have been blasted all – denied that she knew this man, gives this man $500,000.
Are you talking about her recent husband?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, so you're talking about Ilhan Omar when she District 5, so the representative for District 5, who she was married previously, and a lot of the people have mentioned a lot of ethical violations as far as campaign funding, finance violations regarding her recent husband.
You guys, check this out. Check this out. I'm glad Anthony asked that question, but I need to interject this so we beat this dead horse.
Okay.
Anthony's piece was, how did she get elected? Okay.
We voted her in.
We go back to the same damn issue we always have in Black Minnesota. How is it that someone, and I'm not for or against her, I'm just putting it out there how it is. She was in Somalia in a refugee camp. She came to the United States. She comes to Minnesota. She's the congressperson now. You have Black people in North Minneapolis in the 5th Congressional District for years. How was she able to bud in front of the line? If there was a line.
Right.
My question exactly.
Mr. Tucker said, we have to know who's the man behind the curtain, the green man behind the curtain pulling the strings and the levers. Because obviously we don't know who it is.
We know who it is. It's white. It's the white liberal party.
Okay. But with that said, I mean, that's a pretty deep piece. Do you have another comment, Anthony? Because we're rolling up to the end of the show with about 3 minutes left.
I just have one more comment. I know you had a person on a few weeks ago that was really trying to change this child protection area with a bill that it was an outstanding bill, and it was nothing but pushback on that bill. And I'm hoping that's the same type of issue that Jacoles was talking about when we need to make our own plan. I mean, and their excuse is, well, we can't do it. Well, we can't, and that's patently false because we've never gotten a chance to even do it, and that's why we have the disparities, because they're doing it. They've been an abject failure. DHS, for one, has been total abject failure in working with our child protection system, our education systems, our social services, and they've talked about it for years. Maybe it's too big. Maybe it should be broken up. Well, it should be broken up, and it should be a division where we are in charge of our families so that we can orchestrate who gets their rights terminated and why. We can orchestrate the legislation that covers moving these kids out of the home. And we need to really know how that program works, because if they knock on your door, you don't have to do what child protection says until they drag you in the court and you get an order from a judge called a CHIPS petition, which is Child in Need of Protection and Services. Up until that time, services are voluntary. And you can come up with your own plan to say, well, I'm going to address this issue, and these kids can stay in the house. But we don't know any of this stuff. We're always behind the eight ball, and nobody's really educating us about what we're up against. And I think once we know, we can do a better job, and we have to not depend on these outdated, NAACPs, Urban League. I mean, they need to have a new focus. They need to come, okay, this is today's world. You got to come into today's world. And so, I mean, that's my comment.
Okay. Hey, we appreciate the comment. You said a lot. You know, next week, call back a little bit earlier where we can have this conversation. It seems to me like we ought to try to reach out to Senator Bobby Joe Champion and Senator Jeff Hayden. They have never been on this show in the 10 years that Mr. Edwards and I have been here, and I doubt if they'll come on now. But the invite is out there for Senator Bobby Joe Champion and Senator Jeff Hayden.
I really want to send an invite to any of the people that are tuning in, and your representative or a local official, please call in. We will do an interview with you, and we will ask you the hard questions that need to be asked for the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great thing. And
Next week, I'm not sure, but one of the superintendents, either from Minneapolis or St. Paul, might be on. I am kind of dealing with some paperwork on that right now, and we'll see what happens because, you know, there's a finite list of things that they want you to talk, and we don't want to beat anybody up. We want to be respectful here, but we also need the real information. I'd like to thank Mr. Tucker, Queen, M, all the people that called, and the listeners that tuned in. Any last words, Jonathan?
Nope. I just want to thank Mr. Raymond Dean and also all the callers as well for calling in, and we hope to hear from you in the future.
Yep. Thanks for listening.